I believe the role that you're looking for is called the button presser.
Yes, an official button
Exactly.
presser
Yes.
and problem solver. Yes. Okay. Admitting more people. All right. We are live. Okay, cool. Thanks, everybody. Here we go. Hello and welcome to the Starting and Operating a Successful Permaculture Nursery Summit, brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. Today's summit is brought to you by PINA members and for PINA members and the broader permaculture community. I'm Jesse, and I'll be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the formidable Peter Janes, presenting on the topic of perennial propagation and honing in on regionally appropriate plants. Peter Janes is the founder of Tree Eater Farm and Nursery, with an amazing backstory to the name. If you missed it, we can talk about it later. And is a dedicated homesteader and land steward who has spent over 20 years cultivating food, biodiversity, and sustainable practices. His search for rare and diverse plants led him to establish a nursery that not only grows but also sells a carefully curated selection of hardy species suited to his area. From grafting trees and starting seeds to managing the business, Peter ensures that every plant is grown directly on the farm. Committed to skill development in forestry, cultivation, and craftsmanship, he balances farm life with exploring esoteric ideas and fostering community resilience. With the support of his parents, Robert and Priscilla, Tree Eater Farm continues as a multi-generational effort to promote food security, biodiversity, and a deeper connection to the land. Welcome, Peter.
Hi. Hey.
So great to have you.
Hello. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. I'm looking at all these slides and I'll share my screen here.
Well, actually, before you do that, Peter, I got a couple quick questions for you, if you don't mind.
Okay. Yeah.
The first one is, and I just ask everybody this for both of the summits that we've now had, because it's an interesting answer almost always. What impact has permaculture made on your life?
Well, it's kind of directed my life since I was about 20 when I got disillusioned with university and discovered permaculture. And I think for me, it's like a real moral basis about where my life energy goes and what I'm like contributing to the world. And it's directed that ever since then for 25 years.
Yeah, so a significant directional
Significant.
change.
Yeah.
Yes, fantastic. And then the other question is, since we're on the nursery topic and you've been doing nursery as a business, why might someone or why do you approach the permaculture nursery? Like, why is that a viable business option? What do you like about the nursery business, and what might you say to maybe the younger generation who's considering it as an opportunity?
Well, I have to say, for me, it was actually an accident. I didn't intend to do it. I was trying to develop our family property here and couldn't find what I wanted. So I started to collect plants and then ended up with too many and then realized I could start selling them. So it was unintentional. Sometimes, honestly, I regret it because it has taken a lot of my life energy. But I also continue to do it because I just really resonate still with being able to contribute. It being all the plants to the world and help people to discover and grow plants that they otherwise wouldn't be able to find. So I don't know if I lost the second part of your question, but I think that's part of
Yeah, no, just why it's a viable, maybe a viable business opportunity for
it. It
younger
is
folks.
viable. Like, it doesn't make a ton of money as any farming doesn't for the most part, unless it was weed in the 90s, you know, but it's enough to keep me doing it, let's say that, and it's enough to get really good tax write-offs for the development of the property, which more idealistic people, as I was, might turn up their nose at. But you know, as an adult who has cash flow, it's a significant factor. And yeah, it's, you know, we're all just limited by our own imagination and abilities and training. And I mean, anyone can make a permaculture nursery work, and anyone can make money doing it. You just have to be smart about it and keep
Perfect.
trying. It takes a long time. It took me a long time to develop this into what it is now.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was really hoping with this summit, and we at PINA are hoping, like, let's learn from people who've been doing it for 20, 30, 40 years, and like
Yeah.
maybe we can speed up that sort of like on ramp for
For
new
sure.
folks. So
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah.
hopefully, exactly. So without further ado then, and right on that subject, Peter, if you don't mind sharing your screen, and I'll be in the background if you need me, and take it away.
Is my screen shared now?
I see it, but it's in the grid.
Yeah,
Yep,
there.
there you go.
Okay, that didn't work. I don't spend a lot of time in Zune.
Oh, maybe oh yeah,
There we
play from beginning. Perfect.
go. Okay, so I'm actually gonna, sorry, bear with me. I'm gonna move this over so I'm looking at the camera. Okay, there
Yes,
we go.
all good.
So yeah, so like I said, I am primarily a homestead
We see your email now.
oh no, it's the wrong screen. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Technical
So you're just
thing.
gonna have to look at my face sideways then, which is fine.
Okay.
I am primarily a homestead, and most of my passion is still with homesteading, but the nursery is a big part of my life and has been for like almost 20 years now. So this is just a shot of the pot yard, which is kind of the main thing people encounter when they come over in my house and greenhouse in the background. My sort of shtick with the nursery that was kind of integral to me starting it was that I do like maximum diversity, and I'm sourcing things that can't be found otherwise. So you can go to like Walmart to get a cherry tree or an apple tree, but you can come to me to get those, and then you can also get like a Szechuan pepper and a Japanese persimmon. So that's kind of why I think people buy from me still, after all these years. And then also because I'm constantly trying to find new things to add to that catalog, and that keeps people coming back. I do, as you said in the intro, a lot of regionally appropriate hardy things, but part of what I do is also import, collect, smuggle stranger, more experimental things into the area to trial them and to see if they're going to work. So that's also what I offer to people is being able to participate in that trialing process. I do live in what you could call a softwood forest on the west coast of Canada. So it grows cedar, Douglas fir, plants you can't eat. There's very, very little actual native food in the forest here. And so part of my role with the nursery and with my work on our own land is kind of like an ecosystem transformation of turning that inedible forest into an edible forest. So that's an overhead shot of some of the farm, which doesn't make much sense from this scale, but I just wanted to give a sense of the context that I'm working in.
There's a
That
good
also,
question. You might be covering this, Peter, but what zone are you in?
seven-ish minus 15 Celsius would be sort of our killing temperature for the most part. Because of this, I have a whole other life, logging, milling, and dealing with wood products, which is the other half of the tree eater name, is the taking apart trees and using the wood products. So here's an overhead shot of the pot yard. Most of what I do is sell it through the mail online through the website. I used to do a lot more in-person sales events, and as I get older and lazier and more established, I don't need to or want to do those anymore. So most of what I'm doing is from home online, which just involves bare rooting plants and getting them in special expensive cardboard boxes and setting them out. Everything starts in, I only have one big greenhouse. It's a 25 by 60. I wish I had more, but it's a really awesome resource to have a greenhouse, and I wouldn't want anyone to start trying to have a nursery without a greenhouse because it's such an essential tool. But most stuff starts in here and then moves out of here, either into the ground or into bigger pots. And pot management and weeding is like one of the main sort of physical jobs that has to be done here, and I think for a lot of nurseries. I don't think I'll say anything else about that because I'm gonna basically what I'm gonna do with this presentation is I'm gonna go over kind of a parallel stream of different ways you can propagate plants, and for me, with my given conditions, what the best examples of those plants are. Quick shot of in-ground growing. In-ground growing makes much better trees, more healthy trees, bigger, faster. But I personally find it a lot harder to manage than pots. Like, I don't know why, but I hate weeding. I absolutely despise weeding. If I could eliminate weeding from the nursery schedule, it would be so good. So as I mentioned, I'm going to talk about different parallel streams of propagating and then what works best for me in this particular region as examples of those plants. What I'm dealing with here in my location on the west coast of Canada is extreme winter rain that leaches soil nutrition. Very thin soil. It's almost like a rainforest soil that doesn't exist on its own. It only exists within the context of the forest. So when you remove the forest, there's not much left. We technically have what's called shale loam. And then we have what I call and other people call our second winter, which is like the broadest part of summer, sort of July, August, September. Sometimes it's a couple months shorter, sometimes it's a couple months longer, where it basically won't rain. And if there's no irrigation, then everything stops. So it acts as a winter, the dryness. So those are like our main sort of design parameters that we have to work around. This is what I call a barn garden. It was a vegetable garden that I planted with trees a number of years ago, and it's gradually growing in winter shot here. So I'm going to talk about a little event that happened that really clued me into the best way to approach this region. And that was, I was visiting some friends on Orcas Island, which is an American, we call them Gulf Islands, you call them San Juans. And we went to their, those are my two friends there. We went to one of their buddies who's an older guy who's been running a plum orchard there for 30 years. We were there in the summer, and he sells plums to tourists in the summer. It's a good time match, plum ripening and tourist availability. And we were walking around in this orchard, and I was looking around, and this is after I'd been struggling with drought for probably 10 years. And I was like, there's no pipes here. There's not a single pipe on the ground. And so I asked him, and he said, oh yeah, I don't irrigate my trees. I just graft them onto an appropriate rootstock. And I never heard anyone talk about this before at the time. And so all these plums, and there's other things here too, they're all grafted onto a seed-grown rootstock. And this is where things get a little more esoteric, and whether people know what grafting is or what the types of grafting are. I'm going to talk about all that, but I'm going to start by talking about seeds here, because seeds, and you already had the vegetable seed thing, but most people, when they think about fruit trees, don't think about seeds, because the average fruit tree is grafted, and a grafted tree gives you predictability. It's a clone, right? And so you get exactly what you want. You can have an orchard of all the same things. It's very like commercially appropriate for capitalism and predictability. But when you grow something from seed, like these cherry seedlings here, every single one of them is an individual that is going to express just the way we express as individuals, with variation. And so, yeah, for a permaculture situation and for a homestead situation, it's actually really neat, because you end up with evolution happening, and you end up with a variety of time in ripening and a variety of fruit. And most importantly for me, you end up with roots that look like this, that go straight down into the ground, out of the zone of drought into the groundwater. And so this was a big revelation for me for regionally appropriate plants, was I had to be using seedlings and seed-grown rootstock for grafting, because they just have this, and they're an intact organism that has a drive that is, ancestral, to go deep and to find the water. I think the previous presenter talked a little bit about storing seeds. I find whenever I buy seeds on the internet or from other seed providers, they come dried. And to me, a dried seed is like almost entirely useless. I sell some seeds, but not too many, but I handle a lot of seeds for my own purposes, and I will never dry a seed if I have a choice. There's a couple exceptions, but for the most part, I will never dry a seed. I'll harvest them when the fruit's ripe, and I'll let them dry on the counter after I wash them and clean them, because that's a big part about seed storing, is proper washing and cleaning. I'll let them dry for about a day, and then I'll put them in damp peat moss in the fridge. And that usually happens summer, fall. And what happens over the winter in the fridge is they start to do this, which is start to grow the radicals and wake up. And so the issue with it is that you have to be much more sensitive to their needs when they wake up, and then handle them appropriately, just like you would a human infant. You got to watch them and do what they need. But unlike dried seeds that you buy through the mail, they're not all dead, and they're not all impossible to wake back up. You can wake up dry seeds through stratification, but I find that the odds of doing that properly compared to just doing them fresh is just like night and day. So often I'll start them like this. This is what we would call like a community sewing, where you just put a thick layer of them on the surface of some ProMix, and then cover them with some more ProMix. This is really good for space saving. And then when you get a few true leaves, you can split them out and either pot them into their own individual pots or put them outside in a row. But this particular batch of seeds is a bit of a villain for a lot of people, and it's one of my favorite allies on my farm. It's autumn olive, Ileagnus umbellata. It will be invasive in certain parts of the world where it doesn't get cold enough to kill the seed outside. But here it gets cold enough, like we said, down to minus 15, that all the seeds are killed every year on the ground, so they don't spread and become quote unquote invasive. I don't believe in the concept of invasivity, but we're not going to get into that. This tree, I only have so much time here. I can't spend too much time on it. Really cool tree, really productive, amazing fruit, great forage plant for poultry. And I sell a lot of these through the nursery, with the caveat that they're not invasive in my particular bioregion. The thing that seeds give you when you start them, that's a clone of one called Superhero that was found by my friend in Victoria, BC. He calls it the Portuguese superhero because it was brought here by immigrants. But when you start to plant the seeds of autumn olive, you end up with all these interesting things that happen where you get different colored fruits and you also get different times of fruiting. So I'm putting tons of these into my orchard because they all fruit at different times in the summer. So I can kind of like, as I build it out, I can have almost a continuous supply of chicken forage because they all come online at different times. And so they're really, really got potential for that purpose. This is one that I started that I'm just calling the orange autumn olive because not a lot of, most of them are either yellow or red, but this one has orange fruit. Other good seeds for me are these are Italian stone pines. And this is kind of going to bring up the broader point that for you in your area where you might be dealing with different conditions, like maybe you have too much water in the summer, or maybe you're too warm in the winter, you gotta find the people around you who've been doing it longer than you have. In this case, this is my neighbor Bruce. He's probably around 70 now, and he's been farming beside me for 20 years longer than I have. And some of my best plants have come from him. And this is one of them, Italian stone pines. They're taprooted, they're drought tolerant, they're productive on a very long time scale. So they're not very practical commercially, but for a homestead where you can just throw them in the back, they're great. I got these from him. And then you can see these smaller ones in the foreground. They look really spindly. Those are a prune plum, an ungrafted prune plum that came from him. That's also one of the best trees we have on our farm. So, if you're thinking about trees, definitely look around you at people who've been doing it longer than you. These are cool because the only way to get the nuts out of the cones is you put them on top of your wood stove in the winter, and the cones open up like a flower, and then the little nuts fall out. But then the little nuts have a coat on them too, and you have to crack that. And that's why pine nuts are so expensive in the store, because the processing is crazy. Another really regionally appropriate tree that no one was growing that I brought in was hybrid chestnuts. Again, they're taprooted, they're super drought tolerant, they thrive in poor soil. They have a ton of potential here, and I'm continuing to plant more and more of them as time goes on. They also have issues with pollination, and every tree that you make relationships with, you have to learn the sort of species specific issues so that you aren't dictated by them. But chestnuts really need a lot of variety between them. You need variety of cultivars or seedlings to get proper pollination because they express their, how do I say, their sex parts really variably. That's my dog, Alba. I'm also going to put a plug in here because there's a bush variety of chestnut called a chinkapin, which I've had a hell of a time getting here onto our farm. It has a ton of potential because it makes a little mini chestnut that would be another really good goose forage plant or chicken forage plant. So if anyone out there who's watching who wants to do any genetic material exchanges with me, I have a lot of interesting genetics, and I know you do too. And if anyone wants to contact me directly about doing that, please do. The chinkapins sprout in the fall, so right after they're harvested, so they're really hard to ship. They sprout really quickly, and so it's hard to get viable seeds that aren't damaged in the male. Most of the nuts that I do this way in these what are called tree pots. They're from Stewie and Sons, which is an American nursery, and it cost me a fortune to get these pots here, but it wouldn't for most of you. They're kind of like a segregated air pruning bed because when I put things under the crates, so the roots stop growing at the bottom. And as long as you plant a tree in a tree pot within a year or two, you get a really good start. You can see Ian in the back there putting hardware cloth over them. That's the main issue, is that the rodents will steal them out of the tops of the pots. So cats or rodent control are really important. Yeah, so seeds, really important to understand how to work with them. Again, I'm trying to cruise through this really fast. I'm going to talk about cuttings next. Cuttings are great because you can make a lot of one thing really quickly. You can clone a plant and end up with 100 of the same plant, right, within one batch. The downside is you're basically amputating something's arm and then asking it to become a complete creature again. And so you can see the roots coming out of the bottom of this cutting. This cutting's performing well because the roots are growing before the shoots are. But the root system on a cutting will never rival a seedling's root system. That's the downside. So this is just a quick drawing I did of how to do basic cutting techniques. I honestly don't think I have a ton of time to get into that because I want to keep moving through it. I'll also use that as a plug. I do teach a propagation course online through Regenerative Living Online, and if people want to get into the specifics about propagating, you could check that course out. Or of course, there's lots of free online resources as well. Some cutting grown plants are really appropriate for this region. Grapes are one of them. That's in the front. They love heat. They love drought. They're cold hardy. They're a perfect plant for where I live. I love them. I continue to collect varieties of them. And in the back of the truck there, close to the cab, those are elderberries. And elderberries are often really successful here too, as long as they're planted in appropriate microclimate, which is right beside a pond or a stream. So those are just examples of cutting grown plants that work here. Grape. Hardy kiwis, I propagate from cuttings. I love them. They're like my favorite fruit ever. But they need a ton of water and they have a really shallow root system. So you have to sort of budget water to them to grow them here. And so they're not that regionally appropriate. But we all make our exceptions for different things in life, right? I think I have 20 different varieties of female hardy kiwis now, and they're all doing great as long as I water them four times more than I water the grapes, right? Another one I do from cuttings a lot that's super for me and really easy to propagate is figs. They're cold hardy enough to live here. Even in in the worst winter, they'll just get knocked to the ground and then come back. But then when they're mature enough, that won't even happen. It's only in the first year or two of their lives that could happen. They're super tolerant of drought and heat, and they make a really valuable fruit during tourist season that commands a fortune and then also dries really well. And I eat dried figs for as long as they last every winter and never have enough of them for my own needs. So I'm actually going to like put in about 50 of these in the next year in a new area that I'm opening up. And that's how I actually got my start with the nursery, was just being passionate about wanting to grow fig trees and starting like 200 from cuttings. And that was what I took to my first sales event. That was the weird thing that got me started selling plants, was just I have way too many figs I just made. I need to get rid of them. Mulberries are another one that do really well here. Mulberries are funny though because there's about a billion different kinds. Some you can only do from seed, some you can only do grafting, some you can do only from cuttings. And so the devil's in the details. That's a Hunza, another weird find we had. That's like a white fruiting one, probably from the Middle East somewhere. And then these are Illinois Everbearing, which are a grafted mulberry that are the best producers in my particular region here. And I won't get too much into mulberries, but this is more, these are the slides to say you got to learn how a plant is propagated because you can waste your time trying to propagate it the wrong way. And so that's where just online or book resources is really important. So you don't, or learning from someone like me or someone else who's actually done it, because you could try to take, 1,000 cuttings from an apple tree and only one of them will work because apple cuttings don't root, right? Things that will root but have a really hard time rooting, you do this technique called stooling where you're basically pre-rooting a cutting before you remove it from the mother plant. So this is just a quick diagram of that. Those rainbows are lines of sawdust that you gradually pile over the plant during the summer while the shoots are growing, and you can fuse a shoot into also growing roots, and then you harvest it later when the cutting already has roots on it. So it's called stooling or mounding. Again, I'm trying to move faster. That would be the result of stooling, where you have these rooty shoots. And most rootstock for most conventional fruits is produced from stooling. And generally, it's fairly shallow rooted and not as drought tolerant and not as interesting to me as a person at this point in my life. There's another shot of some rooted gumi plants that were done by stooling. Some plants sort of stool themselves, and some of my best plants work this way. This is a sour cherry, also from my old hippie neighbor, where the prune plums came from. And it's an ungrafted tree, so what it'll do is it'll throw up suckers around it, probably a half dozen per tree per year, that I can go and just dig out of the ground with some roots attached to them. And that's like kind of the laziest, easiest way to get a complete tree if it's an ungrafted tree. It is by suckering. So that's another thing to mention for people who are just starting out. But now I'm going to talk about grafting, because grafting gives you this. Grafting gives you all of the fruit that you're used to eating is all from a grafted tree, because it's predictable and it's knowable. And you get this, which is all different varieties of Asian plums, all off grafted trees. You do need more skill and you need some tools for grafting. This is all you need right here in this slide. Knife and tape, labeling, some sanitizing stuff. So it doesn't, if you buy cheap tools, it won't cost you that much to get set up. But if you buy good ones, it's a little more. But that's just a shot for tools. And so this is the main star of the show. This is a grafted tree, and I'm sure you can probably see where the graft is. At the top, the surgical union between the two trees. The top one is a king apple, which is a settler brought in European apple on Denman. The bottom is a very old established native plant in my region called Mallus fusca, or the wild Pacific crab apple. And this to me is the kind of holy blend of regional appropriate horticulture here. Mallus fusca, the native Pacific crab apple by itself, was used by the First Nations here for, well, we don't even know, over 10,000 years. They've been here a long time. But for modern tastes, the apple is only like the size of your thumbnail, or even my pinky nail. I have big hands. And it's hard and it's astringent, and you have to let it bled like a medlar to eat it. So they would put it in wooden boxes full of water with oil on top and let it soften into sort of an applesauce and then eat it. And not a lot of people are interested in that. But you can graft any kind of other apple on top of these Mallus fusca trees. And the really cool thing about Mallus fusca is it's a tap-rooted, seed-grown rootstock that is both amazingly drought-tolerant because of its tap-rootedness, but it's also really strangely totally water-tolerant, in the sense that it'll literally grow in a swamp in standing water in the winter and be totally fine with that. So most of my attention right now is on my own farm, is grafting Mallus fusca and getting it everywhere, because they're also really long-lived perpetual trees, and I could have a heart attack next week. And the one thing, if everyone walked away from the farm, if there was a war or a disaster, the one thing that would survive into the future would be all these Mallus fusca trees with all of the good apples grafted on top of them. That's a variety that came out of Port Alberni. So you can basically put any kind of apple onto Mallus fusca, and some pears too. I haven't experimented as much with the pears. So I'm going to talk a little bit about grafting, and I'm wary of the clock here. The most reliable way to graft is something called T-budding, where you're removing a single. Can you see my mouse cursor?
Yep.
Yeah. You're removing a single bud from the tree that you want to propagate, and you're sort of putting it into a different plant. And the negative way to say that is you're kind of creating a parasite on the plant. But the positive way is just that you're redirecting its growth in the way that you want as a human. It's taped up, and then eventually that bud will grow into the new tree when you decapitate the old tree. It sort of takes over all the energy of the plant. I'm doing this as fast as I can. The good thing about tea budding for grafting is it's like the most successful kind and easiest, and you get the highest take rate. So you can get up to like 90, 100% success on any given graft. But the downside is it takes a year longer than stick grafting. So it's like a 2 year cycle to get a tree. It's a long-term thing. So when you're in a nursery, from start to finish, from start to selling a tree, it's about 3 years. So you have to have many cycles happening so that every year you have something that's finishing. Again, I'm speeding through this. That's what it looks like when you insert a bud into a tree. This happens in the summer, and then you tape it up, and then it just waits there. And then that would be the next spring when you decapitate the rootstock, and you can see that the bud kind of healed into the rootstock. And then that spring after it's decapitated, it'll grow. So that was the bud that was added that's growing. And then this is a very common mistake which is made, which is that the rootstock's always going to try to get around this. The rootstock doesn't want to put its energy through, so it's always going to throw up what we call suckers around it. And that one wasn't removed in time, so all that energy went into the rootstock rather than into the bud. It's a common mistake that happens. The other kind of grafting is called stick grafting, when you actually take two pencil-sized pieces of wood and you surgically join them together. And the upside of that is you get a tree faster within one season, and the downside is that way more of them won't work, and it requires a lot more dexterity with a knife, generally speaking, to make the unions work more. It's more surgical, basically. That's a 1-year-old graft that you can see it has callous healing tissue that's joining them together. There's different ways to do stick grafts. This is the kind most people learn first, which I think is strange because I think it's a lot harder. Whip and tongue, where you have this like lightning bolt style union that gives good strength, but it's hard to pull off with a knife. The easier way to do it is called cleft grafting. Most people tend to be able to pull that off better, and it's just as good of a technique. One thing that really helps grafts work is to heat up the graft in the early spring after you do it, because that brings the plant's energy to heal it up faster so that it doesn't die of disease or some sort of pathogen getting in there in the cold, wet of spring. Where I live, spring is very cold and wet. If you're living in Arizona, this might not be as important because it might be warm enough to not need to heat up the plant, but it's just something I'll note here. Again, I'm speeding through this. You can also buy tools, and I would recommend this to anyone starting out, depending on your budget. A stick grafting tool ranges from $40 on Amazon for this Omega tool that'll last you a couple years before it breaks, to the American made, what are they called? There's one that costs $800, which of course I've never bought, but I bought the cheap Chinese knockoff of that expensive American one on Amazon, and it has a blade that's kind of like that. It's not the Omega shape of the cheap one, but it's kind of like a knife like that. That lasted a few of us sharing it like 3 years before it broke, I think. But it was only $80, I think. And this, if you're not really good with a knife, this takes all of the slowness and the hassle out of stick grafting. So I'd really recommend people check that out if they're curious to start, for sure. So here's another shot of a different Malus fusca apple. This was actually where I first discovered the sort of holy duo. Was on a farm in Cortez from one of my mentors, this guy named Oliver Kellhammer, who was going around his property and doing the same thing, just changing all the Malus fuscas over to domestic apples. So again, drought tolerance, flood tolerance, high quality product, minimum amount of investment and skill to make it, so it's super regionally appropriate from here, and it kind of combines all the different things about, how seedlings are great for tap rooting, but then grafting's great for giving you a predictable product all together in that one tree. You can work over mature trees, like if you have large trees on your farm, and you could do this with if you have like black walnuts growing in your farm, you could like put an English walnut on one using a technique like this, where you just lop off a limb and then stick a whole bunch of small sticks into it. Top working, it's called. So it doesn't have to be a 1-year-old tree like it would be commercially to do the grafting. So at my place, this is often what it looks like now, where I'll walk around and figure out where the mouse fusca is just sprouting from bird poos, and I'll graft it in place, and then I'll throw a tree tube on it so the deers don't kill it. And so they'll look like this for a few years before they get big enough to grow out of the tubes. There's also another variety of plum here that escaped from the first settlers from the orchard's rootstock, and it'll come up here and there. So I'm putting prunus on that too. You can put anything from almond to plum to apricot, even any kind of plum can go on to these wild plums. And so I'm starting to do that too, and getting a really tough rootstock with a more productive. Tree tubes are a great technology too, not just for deer protection, but they also act like these really accelerate the growth of the plant, and you'll get like 2 or 3 times the growth rate in a tree tube that you would without the tree tube. Ultimately, what I'm going for is something that looks like this. And this is like an old settler orchard on Orcas Island. So those trees are probably 100 to 100 and, I don't know, 20 years old. And I would imagine this particular orchard is being grazed by sheep, but for us, where I live, deer kind of occupy the same niche as sheep. So you can have these standard sized fruit trees that can produce a reliable crop without any maintenance or need to protect them from the grazers underneath them. And then the grazers underneath them sort of maintain this sort of, you could kind of almost call it like a climax ecosystem where it doesn't need a lot of human input. So this is kind of my holy grail that I'm aiming for, but with more diversity for sure than just like one kind of apple, of course. I can't sell any of you trees because most of you are in the States. So, don't even ask. There's way too much red tape. It's just insane trying to get plants into the States. Nursery plants, material is different, but nursery plants, no. But this is my website, and you can have a look at it if you're interested. What I can encourage you to do is either take this course through Regenerative Living Online if you do want to learn how to propagate better. And then if you just are interested in the way that I think more about life and pre-apocalyptic adaptation, this is a book that was published by a local publisher, I think just this year actually. It's a series of essays just on like small farming and life and energy and how we make sense of trying to be responsible and moral in the world. That's available either from me or from the publishers called Night Forest Press. You can also order it from them. That's me. I feel like I cruised through that very quickly, but on a good time frame. So if people have questions, I'm totally happy to answer them.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks, Peter. You did great, and that was full of wonderful things. I'm sorry most of us can't buy from you, but I bet there's plenty of people here from Canada. In fact, I see Adrian
I
with
wonder.
a few others from Ontario. So you ship throughout all of Canada, right?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, people in the States have way more options than we do. Like, One Green World's a great nursery that I wish I had access to, that I could buy things from. And then there's other ones, so many other ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, everything I have you can find from them, except maybe with the exception of mouse fusca grafted apples. That would be the only.
That's a hot take, man. I was excited by that.
It's really cool.
Question from Chris. How do you keep your stooling propagations from rotting the trunk in the sawdust?
I don't find that happens. The issue with the stooling is it creeps upward every year. So after, I don't know how many years those have been here there for, but they're too high. So I'm actually going to take an excavator to the entire stooling bed, because the sawdust is gone. It's all grown over with grass. The crowns have every year gone up a couple inches. So I need to tear them all out, overhaul the entire area, and replant them a foot deeper, basically, at this point. But they don't rot for whatever reason here. Maybe it's, I don't know, it's like really wet here in the winter. Are you saying that you've actually had that happen, the rotting?
I don't know. That's a question from Chris, I think. Another question,
I
what
can
is your
see
favorite
type
way to
back
do
in again.
mulch? Oh, sorry, Peter, didn't mean to speak over you. What's
Yeah,
your
he says
favorite?
he's in Florida.
Yeah, well, that makes sense then, right? With the high humidity.
And high temperature too.
What's your favorite way to do mulberry cuttings?
Well, it depends on the type. Like some just won't do it. Like some, like Illinois Everbearing, there's no way you can get it to root. But something like Hunza, I just treat it like everything else, where I do it at the right time of year. I use hormone and I put it on bottom heat in the greenhouse. Typical cutting practice. Nothing out of the ordinary. But you just have to make sure that the type you're trying to do from cuttings actually will work, because some of them just won't work.
And what Ryan asked, what fig varieties you've grown are your favorite? Like, I know you've done a lot of them, but which ones are standouts?
Yeah, for us, it's hands down Desert King or Dessert King.
Oh.
That's the king is like everything else is like a really bad second best to the king.
Okay, good to know. Can
But
you
that's
talk?
me, right? That's just in this particular region. We only get a Breva crop here. Our summers aren't long enough for a main crop. So King does a good Breva crop. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Keith is in the chat. He said he grows a Adriatic, I think, fig,
I've never grown that one.
in a greenhouse, and I've tasted that one. That one's fantastic. That's good for
I mean,
me.
they're all fantastic when they work, right? But you just have to find the ones that work where you live. That's the thing. And that's where you have to just go find who's doing it already and get something from them. Yeah.
What about there's a question from Evan. Can you talk about potting media and the depth slash size of tree pots?
Media, I make my own out of what, I mean, I do have to buy some things, but I try to make it cheaply. So it's a mixture of manure, my own or something I can buy cheaply, and then hardwood sawdust, and then peat moss. And I know there's some controversy around peat moss, but I just have to use it because it's affordable. But yeah, it's those three things, and then also a mixture of 12 different bagged amendments. So, you know, there's a lot of detail there that we could talk about at some other point when there's more time. And then for the tree pots, I use the 3x10 mini tree pots and the 4x13 tree pots from Stewie. The 3x10s are great because they fit 16 in a milk crate, and the 4x13s are great because they fit 9 perfectly. So you get these nice compact milk crate bundles out of them.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. If you have time and the ability, Peter, it'd be cool if you could share the bagged, like the minerals and the nutrients you put in. I mean, you could do that way later in the PCX if you think about it. And no pressure if you're just busy, don't worry about it. Serious Jane asks a serious question. Any insights on plant naturalization slash seed naturalization?
I guess I'd have to know what you mean by naturalization. I would assume you mean planting something and then having it become part of the ecosystem and getting legs of its own. Is that what we're thinking?
That's what I
Yeah.
interpreted it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I want to be doing as a person, is naturalizing edible, useful plants that all of the creatures of the earth can eat from. And so that's why things like that own root cherry and that own root plum that will actually sucker and thicket. I have other plants like that too that'll do that and actually take over an area. That's like that's a goal to me, but other people would call that an invasive plant going AWOL and destroying an ecosystem, a native ecosystem. So there's a lot of like interesting sort of moral and intellectual discussion around the process of naturalization.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. It can get like a thorny topic to talk about at
It's a
times.
thorny topic. And like I said, I don't really believe in invasivity if it's a plant that is useful to everybody, human and non-human. And if it's not displacing some rare critical endangered ecosystem, that's where I will be like, okay, we don't want things encroaching on that rare critical endangered culturally significant ecosystem. That's where I will draw a line and not, you know, mess that up.
Beth asked a question about dwarf fruit tree grafting. Do you have any experience with or tips on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. It's just when you want a dwarf, you're picking a certain kind of rootstock that creates a smaller overall tree, produces faster. Dwarfs generally need staking and higher levels of irrigation, and they will die faster. They don't have as long of a lifespan. So you're choosing today over tomorrow with the dwarf, which is fine. It's, you know, everyone has constraints and factors they're choosing with. I'm not as interested in them as you've heard me say, but the techniques are all the same. It's just you need to pick a certain numbered clonal rootstock for dwarf. So for apples, it would be like M9 or M27 would be good dwarfing rootstocks. And other things don't really have dwarfing rootstocks. Like with plums, it's harder to find them, and with pears, it's harder to find them. So you just have to do your research on overall cultivars.
Also, taking a tip from Greg, if you're in an urban space or something, you can always prune things to be a size that you sort of want.
You can, to a certain degree. After a while, you're really fighting nature, though, if you're trying to keep a standard tree dwarf sized.
Mike asked a series of questions, and Mike, I may miss some of these, but he says, my understanding is that most fruit trees don't grow taproots, and if so, then only from seed. Is that correct?
Yeah, again, it depends on the rootstock. If it's a seed-grown rootstock, it'll grow a taproot. And some of the clonal rootstocks will tend to be taprooting, like Bud 118 is very drought-resistant rootstock, and I can only assume that's because it grows a bit of a taproot. But most of them are more like surface mat rooting.
Will rootstock grown
Go ahead.
will rootstock grown in a pot and then transplanted grow a taproot, or must it be grown in its final home?
If its tendency is to grow a taproot, it will grow a taproot in a pot. But what'll happen is the taproot will hit the bottom of the pot, and then it'll just start spinning and twisting on itself and getting confused and frustrated. So, you with rootstock with root with taprooted trees, there's way more responsibility on you to manage them properly by not letting them get frustrated in a pot. Air pruning is one way you can keep them from spinning, because if there is a gap of air under the pot when the taproot hits it, it'll sort of just wait. But then that's also a process of stunting something. So ideally, within a year or two, you're always getting it into a place where it can do what it wants to do.
That's great. Awesome, guys. I think I got all the questions. If you have any more, go ahead and throw them in. Peter, this has been great. Oh, here's another one coming from Tara. How to find source for information for grafting steps for grafting onto mature trees. I wonder, does your course cover top grafting?
I don't talk about that too much, because it's not really a production technique. It's more like something you do in your own yard. But I mean, if you search for it, you'll find it. It's often called top working, and then there's another name for it that I'm sort of gapping on right now, where you're overworking an orchard. Just search, you'll find it. And in the end, really, all you don't even have to. You don't even have to follow anyone else's advice bark grafting. Yeah, totally. If you understand the principles of grafting, which is that the cambium of the rootstock needs to be in direct contact with the cambium of the scion. So there's 100 ways you can do that, and it's fun to look at antique books that have all these different ways, because it's like kind of like it turns into this weird intricate art form of different ways you can join cambium. But if you have if that's the branch of the rootstock, the sign can go in this way, or it can go this way, or it can go this way, or it can go this way. It's just you have to follow the principles of cambium touching. So just keep that in mind as you do the research.
Yeah, that's great. Have you done any spring budding?
I don't rely on it. Like you might mean chip budding, which you can do any time of year. It's kind of like this weird in between stick grafting and bud grafting, where you're using a bud, but you're leaving the wood inside the bud, and you don't have to be as seasonally dictated by that as you do tea budding. Yeah, it works well. It's just a different technique, and for time constraints, I didn't cover it today because people tend to just go with either tea or stick grafting, but definitely worth looking at chip budding.
Perfect. You
And you
know,
can
I
do it
didn't.
over the entire course of the growing season, and it just gives you one more tool in time.
Yes. I haven't asked you yet, but I've been trying to ask everybody, are there any like go-to books for someone starting like a nursery management library? Like, oh, you got to have this book or this set of books. Are there any that come to
The
mind?
one that I've always had that I started out with is this big purple book called Plant Propagation. It's a big hardcover textbook. And the good thing about that book is It's not edible specific, but there are edibles in it, but it does go over like each plant and say these are the ways you can propagate this plant, which is kind of hard to find.
Okay.
And then it also has information on the techniques themselves. But I don't remember the names of the authors, unfortunately, but it's a big purple hardcover called Plant Propagation.
And it's like a real textbook, correct?
It's a textbook,
Yeah, I think I know that one. I'll try to track it down if somebody else can
yeah.
find it too. Well, this is great,
Yeah,
Peter. Go ahead.
if you show me how to add things to wherever people are looking, I can do that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, here, let me show you how to do that right now, and I'll show
And you can
everybody
do it
how to.
later too. I mean, just so I know. Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is useful for everybody. So, I think most of y'all are figuring it out by now, but if you have any links or things to share, this is the place to do it. Like if you have your Amazon link or something like that, you can also share pictures here, or files or whatnot. So
Okay, cool.
feel free to do that. It would be great to get what we'll try to do with all these presentations is get ChatGPT or something to pull out all the resources. That's one of the benefits I think of like a these AI models is they're really good at pulling out like, oh, here are all the books that were mentioned or the types of techniques that Peter mentioned. And then we can make a big old list at some point, which we might keep up in this bar. We might get a new bar called resources. So keep an eye out for that. And while I'm doing this, let me just take the opportunity to say thank you to or just sort of like give you all an overview of the PCX. This is a mighty network sort of app, right? We all use this here. And it's co-hosted by ARC, the Association for Regenerative Culture, which I saw Lee was in the chat. So that's Lee and Suzanne Bonfass, and just they're just wonderful people. And them working with Pina. So this site is like, you know how like most PDCs have a PDC cohort group, but it's usually on Facebook. It's like a private group where you can keep talking to all the friends that you met at the PDC. Well, unfortunately, it's on Facebook. So we're thinking, okay, this could be a very dedicated space run by regenerative culturists and sort of like thinking of things from the permaculture perspective to host your cohort spaces and that sort of thing. And also summits. So we can host all the summit content for years to come can be on here. So I just want people to know that it's not just like a Facebook type place. It's kind of like an app too, where you can store a lot of information. You can have, if you have your own like private hub, you know, like my buddy and I have Washtenaw Permaculture. We could have all our Washtenaw Permaculture members on here for after the meetings to share information and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to shout out both Pina and ARC and let everybody know who's running this shindig here. So thanks, everybody. And I may have missed some new ones that came in, but with respect to time, I'm just gonna bid you adieu, Peter, and say thanks one more time. This is great information. This will be something that people can really sort of dive into the ins and outs of how to actually do all these grafting techniques and start and really, like you say, hone in on what's gonna work for you because what's working for you, Peter, is not gonna be the same for me here in Michigan, but a lot of the techniques will translate. A lot of the, you know, ways to manage like perennials will translate. So thank you so
Yeah,
much,
totally.
Peter. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening. Hope it was useful.
Yeah, thanks everybody, and we'll see you in the next one. Ben Caesar coming up next in about 5 minutes. See you then. Bye.
Bye.